This is Carrie from Wrap Your Head Around Sucks. This is the Expecting Errorless podcast, now with the Digitent Network. How's it going, guys? Hope you're having an amazing week. Before we get started, lots going on our Wrap Your Head Around Sucks. We have rolled out our live weekly foam rolling and ball class Monday and Thursday evenings. I would love to have you. I'd love to see you in person on Zoom, get to know you better. We have a full beginner to intermediate Silks course that's online, a free course, an aerial rehab course if you're coming back to your practice, either from just an injury, postpartum, etc., and then Silks teacher training. All right, my friends. This is Cindy Dabrowska. She is a registered dietitian and herself someone who has suffered from endometriosis. I've actually been trying to track down and nail down a practitioner who can help us better understand endometriosis, what it is, and how it affects so many women in so many different ways. So I am so excited for you guys to hear this interview. Let's get started. I don't know why, but it took me a long time to nail down somebody who could talk to me about endometriosis. And I know you're not an MD, but for some reason, and I have a student, her name is Erica Nise, and she suffers from endo, and she is always talking to me about it, and it didn't occur to me until I met her how widespread the symptoms can be, how it can like take over your entire life in ways that I couldn't even imagine. You know, like, you think it's something to do with the uterus, but it's not necessarily. Can you explain to our listeners that this population, mostly women, mostly people who are very fit and or are just love this exercise that we do together, which is aerial or circus. We're doing a lot of upper body training. We are doing a lot of the pelvic floor is so involved with all of our movement. And in this particular population too, because it's expecting areas, there's a lot of women who are doing this activity and then also their moms. They're doing all the things that moms do. So I'm sure sprinkled in there are women who are suffering from endometriosis. And then also women who just, like me, I don't suffer from it, thankfully, and I don't know very much about it, like only through my girlfriends. And if you could introduce yourself a little bit about your background and your experience, and then what endometriosis is to start.
Yeah, that would be a good place to start.
Yeah.
So my name is Cindy Dabrowska. I'm a endometriosis specialized registered dietitian. I do practice a little bit. I guess my approach is a little bit more unique because I am more functional minded. So diet is a very central, important part of how I approach, care with my patient population, but also looking at all of the hallmarks that we know, all the hallmarks of endometriosis, including gut health, immune function, hormones, diet, inflammation, nervous system dysfunction, all of that is also my approach to how I support my endometriosis patients. In terms of my background, like I said, I'm a registered dietitian, like a lot of healthcare providers. I have a very personal tie to endometriosis because I suffer with endometriosis myself. I don't know. I'm assuming there's no such thing as TMI on this.
No, there is no such
podcast
thing
in this and in this space in general. But from my very first period at 12 years old, I had extremely debilitating periods, very, very painful. And of course, much like endometriosis does, it evolved over time and my symptoms evolved over time. And so I went through that full gamut that most women with endometriosis go through to try and find some kind of symptom resolution. You know, I tried the hormonal therapies. I did have surgery. I did have a laparoscopy with excision back in 2018. And, I was looking for so long, what is going to be the management strategy that works best for me. And even before I started my studies in the nutrition space, I thought to myself, you know, there are so many chronic inflammatory conditions that are managed with diet and lifestyle. Why couldn't endometriosis be the same? And so then I embarked on this journey to try and find, you know, what is the best diet for me and what supplements are going to work for me and what is my capacity to exercise and what forms of exercise should I be doing? And I personally found a lot of relief with that, right? Like I fully manage my endometriosis with diet, lifestyle, and targeted supplementation. Like I haven't been on any kind of hormone therapy for many, many years. And I thought, why not bring that to other women? Right. And I do want to put a little bit of a disclosure here, like endometriosis, like what you alluded to previously, it affects women so differently. Like no two women experience it the exact same way. You know, if you're interested, I can definitely talk a little bit about like silent endo versus the characteristic symptoms of endometriosis. But no two people really experience it exactly the same way. And so I do want to encourage people to, you know, consider holistic natural strategies. But just, I don't want to also be on your podcast saying like, this is the only and best way for everybody with endo. Like it is an extremely complex condition. And then in terms of what it is, I don't know. I don't even, I should warn you, Carrie, I do bounce around a little bit with on podcasts. Like I tend to go on rants because there's just like so many things I love to say and want to say, and there's just so many things to say. So I've warned you and your listeners.
Oh, no worries. It is, is it an autoimmune? First and foremost.
So it hasn't formally been identified as such, but there are autoimmune components in endometriosis for sure. Like the way that some of the immune cells function in endo is very autoimmune like, but it hasn't formally been diagnosed as such. So endometriosis is a condition where tissue that is similar, but not identical. So there are still lots of differences in the tissue that lines the uterus, the endometrium and endometrial like tissue. That's the endometriosis lesions. It's similar, but not the same. And this tissue grows outside the uterus it's been found at this point and on every organ of the body. So there's really no organ that is safe from endometriosis. And it responds to those hormonal fluctuations throughout the cycle. So when we bleed during menstruation, those endometriosis lesions also bleed. But because the blood doesn't have anywhere to escape to, it starts to form scar tissue and these lesions inside the abdomen or other places throughout the body. And that can be extremely painful. It can affect organ function, certainly does affect fertility. And so that is what endometriosis is. Did you want me to talk a little bit about some of the symptoms?
Oh, yes, please. And then also the silent versus, please.
Sure. Yeah, so some of the characteristic symptoms of endo would be extremely painful, debilitating periods. It's probably the most characteristic symptom, although pain is not limited to just that part of the cycle. Some women will have really extreme ovulation pain. Some women, will just be in pain all cycle long, which is very unfortunate and very heartbreaking to hear. There's a lot of GI involvement as well with endometriosis. So the statistic is something insane, like 90 to 92% of endo sufferers will have some kind of GI involvement. So bloating or constipation or hard to pass stools or diarrhea or IBS type symptoms, like being very reactive to certain foods or just reactive in general. So that's a very, very common symptom. Lower back cramping, pelvic pain. I mentioned already like mid-cycle pain, spotting is common. You can get mid-cycle spotting, heavy bleeding with clots. Infertility is a huge symptom of endometriosis. About 50% of infertility cases are not assumed, but about 50% of infertility cases are due to endometriosis. And then within the endometriosis population, about 30% of women will struggle to conceive. That doesn't mean that all 100% of that 30% will not go on to have a successful pregnancy, but it's quite a large statistic for the population. So low energy, fatigue, brain fog, these are common ones as well. Some women report having pain in the legs as well. And then I always make a point of mentioning also that it's not just these physical symptoms, but endometriosis can be extremely isolating. There are some really big numbers in the endometriosis space related to how many sufferers experience some form of depression or anxiety. Like, it's very, very isolating. And there isn't really a lot of good care for endometriosis sufferers. Like, there's a lot of gaslighting that happens in this space, and there's not really a lot of good treatment options or management options. And so a lot of endo sufferers are left to feel very alone and gaslit. And so I always make a point to, you know, to bring that up as well. It's not just physical symptoms. Also things like UTI or UTI like symptoms, especially when somebody has endo on the ureters or on the bladder, can be really common as well. So a very, very long list of symptoms are possible with endometriosis for sure. And then in terms of silent and sort of the characteristic presentation of endometriosis, silent endometriosis, it basically is what it sounds like. It's endometriosis, but it doesn't really present with those characteristic symptoms. So women with silent endo don't really have pain. They don't really have a lot of GI related symptoms. They wouldn't know that there's anything wrong or that they have endometriosis. Typically the first sign is they've been trying to conceive for, you know, for a longer period of time without success. And then if they happen to have a good doctor or a good RE who will investigate and maybe recommend, okay, let's do a laparoscopy, let's see if you have endometriosis, then they'll have the endometriosis excised and diagnosed at that point. And that's typically the first symptom in somebody with silent endo is infertility. They just can't conceive and nobody seems to know why. So that would be the difference between silent and sort of the characteristic endometriosis and some of the symptoms that you might see in somebody who has it.
Wow, this sounds terrible. Sounds terrible. Mm-hmm. And you started feeling it right when you got your period when you were very young. Is that normal? Is that common?
That's a good question. I mean, the presentation of endometriosis really varies. Like, some women will have presentation right from the very start, right from their very first period or within the first year or two of getting their period. For some women, their symptoms will ramp up after a cycle of IVF, or for others, it might be after childbirth, or for others, they might not start experiencing symptoms until their, you know, early to mid 20s, for example. So it's not like every single person who has it, it doesn't, like, their symptoms aren't going to always present exactly the same way and right away off the get-go, like when they get their periods. So that's another thing that makes endo really complex and very complicated, because yeah, it's not like you're going to start experiencing symptoms from the very first period ever. So hopefully I answered that question.
Okay. So let's just say, like, I have IBS. Or let's just say a woman who is in their 40s tries to start conceiving and unsuccessful. Is it the type of thing that doctors are diagnosing? Like, are they saying to women, you might have endometriosis, like, this could be a possibility, and how do you check for this? Like, I feel like you'd have to have a... Does the doctor have to be like the Dr. House from that TV show to figure this out?
I love that show.
Yeah, the show's great.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's really a mixed bag. I do think that endometriosis is getting a little bit more attention now than it was, say, 5, 10 or more years ago. There is a lot more advocacy now, but I would say that it's still extremely common for a patient to present with these symptoms to their doctor, and the doctor basically give them one of two options, which is to become pregnant or go on hormone therapy. That is typically how endometriosis is managed. It's managed with some kind of hormone therapy. So either birth control or some kind of hormonal IUD or some kind of like chemical menopause inducing medication like Lupron or Alyssa. That's like the typical management strategy through traditional sort of Western medicine. And then to get a diagnosis, for the longest time, it's been through a laparoscopy, which is a type of surgery. And part of the reason why is because the lesions actually have to be biopsied. So, for example, when I had my surgery, the endometriosis was found in multiple different locations. And what they found on my left abdominal wall turned out just to be scar tissue, but all the other areas that they biopsied turned out to be endometriosis. And it's really hard to, this is my understanding anyway, because full disclosure, I'm not a surgeon, right? I don't perform these surgeries regularly, so I can't really speak from firsthand experience, but my understanding is it is hard to be able to tell the difference between something like scar tissue and the endometriosis lesions. And so they do have to biopsy them. But there are some specialists in the field of endometriosis who are attempting to bring a less invasive form of diagnosing endometriosis to endometriosis patients through advanced ultrasound. So it's an advanced form of ultrasound which apparently can show endometriosis without actually having to go under through and perform the laparoscopy. I've spoken to many of these specialists. They tell me that they are able to tell the difference through the laparoscopy. I mean, again, I can't speak to this because I'm not a surgeon, but I'm told that they're able to tell the difference. And especially if somebody has deep infiltrating endo, so the endo that will basically infiltrate the organs or the tissue a certain depth, it's a little bit easier to see through ultrasound, or like large endometriomas, which are cysts that form as part of a more advanced stage of endometriosis. They can see those through ultrasound, and they can. Through this advanced ultrasound technology, and they can diagnose it that way. But that is sort of the gold standard management and diagnostic procedure for diagnosing endometriosis. Yeah, what else can I add to that? So that is typically how it's diagnosed. There are some, and I'm always careful to preface by saying like these are not diagnostic for endo. Like, for example, there's a test called Receptiva where they do I believe it's a biopsy of the uterine lining. Is it a biopsy of the uterine lining? I could be wrong about that. Don't quote me about that. But anyway, the test is called Receptiva, and a positive Receptiva test is strongly correlated with a positive endometriosis diagnosis, but it's not diagnostic for endometriosis, right? You would still then have to go on to get a laparoscopy, or, talk with one of these specialists who perform the advanced ultrasounds. But that's how it's diagnosed.
Okay, I wanted to go into your specialty, your field, when it comes to the diet and then dealing with fertility. So you are well managed through diet and lifestyle. What are the things that you changed that help it be better all the time?
So I will say that it wasn't a very linear journey. Like, it took me probably about 2 solid years of trial and error and trying to figure out what was going to work for me, which is why I do what I do, to really cut that time down for my patients and for my clients. Like, I want to be able to help them figure out what's going to work for them sooner, rather than spending all this other time while also remaining in pain, because all that time that you're investigating all these things, you're still symptomatic. For me personally, I mean, it's been a really, really long time that I've been managing, like probably close to 10 years without any kind of hormones. So it's really just so I guess the way that I manage might be a little bit different from the way that I do in practice. So maybe I'll give you both kind of answers. For me, there are certain things that I'm looking out for depending on where I am in my cycle. So it would be very unwise for me to, go out for a night of drinking the week leading into my period. Alcohol is a big trigger for me. That probably wouldn't end well for me. I do also have a pretty negative response to gluten. There isn't a lot of research with when it comes to gluten and endo, but there are some smaller studies that show that the majority of endo sufferers responded positively to removing gluten from the diet. So their pain symptoms did improve with gluten removal. So that's something that applies to me. I don't fully exclude gluten from my diet, but that certainly is a management strategy that works for me. And then I have some targeted supplements that I like to include in my supplement regimen. Like I do have a quality multi prenatal that I like to take, fish oils, which, you know, I'll sometimes skip on if I'm getting the omega-3s from diet, but omega-3s are essential. They do need to come from our diet. And so if we're not getting them from oily fish, we really need to be taking a quality supplement. Activity is something that really, really serves my body well as well. So my husband and I try and keep ourselves accountable, getting to the gym, going for walks, keeping active, because that seems to have a really, really positive effect on me personally and on my body. That is something that I've experienced more recently. So those are just kind of a couple of the things. And then I do also take something called low dose naltrexone. It is a medication that needs to be prescribed. It's not a hormonal medication and acts on the endocannabinoid system and boosts endorphins in the body. And that helps with pain management. So low dose naltrexone is a prescription medication. It's typically prescribed in high doses in populations that have some kind of addictions, like drug or alcohol addictions, things like that. But in low doses, it's been shown to be very effective for supporting the immune system and boosting those endorphins to help with pain management in the endometriosis population and other chronic illness populations. So I believe it has been used with like fibromyalgia patients and cancer patients and things like that. So that has been a big part of my management strategy as well. So I take that. For anybody who might be listening, who has endo, they can certainly bring that to their doctor and ask if it's something that would be worth trialing. And then in terms of the way that I would manage with clients, right, because I'm my own person, like I know what's going on in my body, but when it comes to supporting somebody else, the way that I like to approach that is by looking at all the ways that endometriosis affects the body, right, all the hallmarks of endometriosis. So first thing we're looking at is that immune dysfunction component, which you alluded to previously, right? You mentioned, you asked me, is it autoimmune? The understanding is that endo is a condition of immune dysfunction, right? So in somebody who doesn't have endometriosis, their immune cells are working, you know, top notch, 100%. They're working just fine. So when endometriosis attempts to establish, the immune system will get a signal. It'll rush into that location, clear away the endo lesions that are attempting to establish. They clear it away and then it doesn't establish and grow. But in somebody with endo, the immune system is a bit dysfunctional. And so these endo lesions, I'm obviously simplifying this a little bit, but these endo lesions will, you know, attempt to establish, the immune system will rush in. Only part of the endometriosis lesions will be wiped away because the immune system isn't at like full capacity. And so part of the establishing endo lesions, they will establish, they'll develop a blood supply and they'll start to grow. So there's this dysfunction in the immune system that's at the heart really of endometriosis. So in terms of my practice, I'm at the very least, I'm looking at improving intake of all vitamins and minerals that support immune function, things like vitamin D, omega-3, zinc, selenium, adequate amino acids, retinol, vitamin D, if I didn't say that already. So I'm making sure that the patient is getting all of those in. And then, you know, we want to be active. You know, physical activity is one of the most important things you can do for your immune system. You want to be supporting healthy cortisol levels with full spectrum light and, you know, managing stress and things like that. Like there's so many things I could say about this, but I, you know, recognize that we don't have an infinite amount of time, but that's one component. Then there's the gut health side, right? So if a person comes to me and they're experiencing every single GI symptom under the sun, they're bloated all the time, they're getting heartburn, they're getting reflux, they're constipated or having chronic loose stools, or they have a history with antibiotics, that is going to have a massive impact on the way that you live with endometriosis. You're going to have really aggressive symptoms. And so we're working on that. And that could be through, you know, like a tailored GI protocol that it might involve some GI lining support. It might involve some prebiotics, some concentrated prebiotic fibers. It may involve some probiotics. It may involve, you know, tweaks in the diet, making sure we're getting more color from our plant foods, more resistant starches in the diet. So, but the milestone there is to completely resolve those GI symptoms. Like having endometriosis doesn't mean that you just accept the fact that you're going to have these IBS or GI-related symptoms. I'm a very demanding practitioner. I want those symptoms to be completely gone, right? That's going to significantly improve your quality of life. The third thing would be hormones, right? We know that endo is an estrogen-dependent condition. And so I like to do some comprehensive hormonal testing with my patients. Look to see, how is estrogen being cleared through your liver? What are your progesterone to estrogen ratio like? Is your testosterone low? Is your DHEA sulfate low or high? What is your cortisol doing? Like, all of these things will affect your pain levels, your immune function. They're all incredibly important to assess, looking at prolactin levels, looking at thyroid function. Hypothyroidism, so sluggish thyroid function, is associated with more severe forms of endometriosis and more pain symptoms with endometriosis. So all of these things are connected. And then, of course, things like looking at inflammation. I'm looking at anything and anything, anything and anything. Okay, that was, you know what I mean? I'm looking at anything that might be driving inflammation in the body, right? Like, do you have elevated liver enzymes? What is your glucose like? Do you have insulin resistance, right? Like, I'm looking at anything, and we're working on improving that, right? Because we want to reduce the overall inflammatory load in the body. And then I'm also looking at things like nervous system function. Are you depleted in magnesium? Are you depleted in potassium? Do you experience heart palpitations? Do you get racing thoughts in the evening? Are you tired and wired? Are there any indicators that your nervous system may be off? Because that's also going to affect your immune function. It's also going to affect your hormonal profile. And so I'm looking at all of those things. And then we're creating targeted interventions so that we can get you feeling better. And that's sort of my approach with my patients. That was a really long answer. I apologize.
No, I love it. So that's the big difference between immune dysfunction and then autoimmune, because you're actually trying to boost the immune system. And if it was truly an autoimmune, like Crohn's, they try to dampen the immune response.
Yeah, that's another really good point because so technically, yes, you're correct. We want to improve the immune function, right? Because if it's in a condition of immune dysfunction, we want to support the cells of the immune system to be able to clear that endometriosis away. So that is correct. But the reason why I made that comment about it being an interesting question is because in somebody who's trying to conceive, who has endometriosis, in some women with endo, when so your immune system basically has like two options, right? Like, your immune system can either, after years and years and years of chronic inflammation, your immune system basically can either work extremely well, right? It can almost become like primed, where it just gets really good at clearing things away, or it's just a really aggressive response. Because if you're somebody who's eating really well, you're otherwise taking care of your body, you're exercising, you're really setting your immune system up for success. It doesn't mean endo is not going to establish and grow, but you're really setting your immune system up for success. And then the other branch of this, I suppose you can say, is the immune system will weaken, right? If you've been dealing with this chronic inflammation for years and years and years, and you're under eating, maybe you're a bit underweight, maybe you're showing other signs of weakened immunity, like being really, really fatigued all day, maybe wounds that are slow to heal, very low progesterone levels. I mean, there's a long list of symptoms that I can list off here, but chances are your immune system is going to be very, very weak, right? It's not going to be thriving very well. Maybe you have chronic vitamin D deficiency. There's a number of things that I can comment here. Then, yeah, your immune system is going to be very weak, right? It's not going to be thriving very well. But in somebody who's, I don't know if I'm making any sense
You
right
are,
now,
you
but
are. Yeah.
the first part, it's more concerning when you're trying to conceive, right? Because a couple things happen when you're trying to conceive. First of all, sperm is foreign to the female body, and so there is an immune reaction that happens when sperm enters the body, the female body. you don't want your immune system to be too aggressive, right? You want that sperm to be able to travel up to the egg because your goal is conception and pregnancy. So if you're if your immune system is a little bit too primed, a little bit too aggressive, which can happen with some women who have endo, then that actually may make it a little bit more challenging for you to achieve that pregnancy. Yeah, that's, I think I'll leave it there. That's the comment I wanted to make. It's hard to assess who kind of falls into what branch of the immune system, but it's certainly something that happened, right? Your body can adapt and it can go, yep, this has been happening for the last, 15, 16 years. We were getting all of the resources that we need to keep this immune response going. We're going to go hard. The immune system is going to respond aggressively. And that basically the only issue with that really is when trying to conceive, right? Your immune system is a little bit more primed.
Okay. So let's talk about the fertility. If you had a client come to you, they already know they have endometriosis and they're trying to conceive and unsuccessful, what are the steps that you would have them take?
Yeah, so very similar to what I just finished explaining, right? I'm thinking about all the ways that we know endometriosis affects fertility. So there's the immune component, right? So I'm looking at what's going on with the immune system. Is there any indicators of a very strong immune response, or are there indicators that the immune response is maybe very weak or underperforming? Neither of those scenarios are good for fertility. So what I typically like to see is, I like to go through the full gamut of like, are there any indicators of autoimmunity? I like to look at TPO, TG antibodies, right? Antibodies against the thyroid, a general ANA, anti-nuclear antibody immune marker. I like to look at a CBC, complete blood count, see if there's anything in those immune cells that are indicating that your immune system is either active or underactive, right? And then we know exactly what we need to do. If your white blood cells have been chronically low, so under 5 for like the last 2, 3, maybe more years, that is definitely related to your inability to conceive. Like there is something going on with your immune system that we can then deep dive into. So does that make sense?
Yes, kind of. Yeah. I'm following you though.
So anyway, the first thing I'm looking at is immunity, right? Because when you do become pregnant, there is this very beautiful switch in the immune system that has to happen in order for basically the woman's body to nurture and grow baby, right? And so if there's something off with your immune system that could predispose you, unfortunately, to early losses or chemical pregnancies, for example. So we want to make sure your immune system is functioning as best as is possible, right? So that's one thing I'm exploring. I'm exploring the immune side of things. I forgot to mention this previously, but the gut health side of things, right? So I usually pair them together because about 70-80% of our immune system is located in the gut. So when there's something off in the gut, you can't expect your immune system to be functioning well. So that's the second sort of place I look, right? Especially when somebody has GI symptoms. I have found in my practice that working on gut health is one of the biggest and most important steps to achieving a healthy pregnancy and being able to sustain that pregnancy for 9 months. If there is something off there, if you have a history with antibiotics, if you're experiencing all sorts of just super uncomfortable GI symptoms, that is a really, really, really good place to start. So that's another thing I'm looking at. And then I'm looking to optimize those fertility specific hormones, right? We're looking to make sure your progesterone levels are healthy, that they're not dropping too aggressively in the luteal phase, right? Which is that phase between ovulation and the start of your period. I'm looking to optimize testosterone because it's really important for follicular genesis, right? For a follicle development that ultimately turns into an egg, right? That you ovulate. I'm looking at DHEA sulfate, which is really important for the quality of your eggs. I'm looking at prolactin, because if prolactin is too high, it can actually mess with your luteinizing hormone and your follicle stimulating hormone, which can then affect ovulation, right? We want you ovulating and we want you to have a healthy, robust ovulation, because then that corresponds with healthy progesterone levels in the luteal phase. And elevated prolactin is very common in the endometriosis population. So I'm looking at that. I'm also looking at estrogen levels. Are you metabolizing it really well through your liver and out with your stools? If you're chronically constipated and you're having estrogen dominant symptoms, I'm not surprised by that, right? Because estrogen is removed in two steps in the liver and then one step through the stools. So if you're not able to get it out of your body because you're constipated, we need to get the bowels moving. So I'm looking at those hormones. I'm also looking at the thyroid. I want to make sure your thyroid is functioning well. The two most common reasons for early losses are low progesterone and thyroid dysfunction. So we really want to make sure that those are optimized. So those are kind of like the big areas I'm looking at. And then inflammation. We know that inflammation is huge with endo. It's a huge hindrance to fertility, both localized inflammation around the uterus and the ovaries, as well as systemic, right? So throughout the entire body. So anything and everything we can do to reduce inflammation for fertility is going to, you know, hopefully lead to a successful pregnancy and conception. So yeah, I mean, anything, if your sugars are high, if your insulin is elevated, if your cholesterol is elevated, if your diet is very processed, or you're consuming a lot of alcohol or something like that. I mean, I hope you're not if you're trying to conceive, but anything that we can do to kind of reduce the overall inflammation in your body is what we'd be working on there. So those would be kind of the big areas. And then in more advanced cases, if we're, you know, checking off all those boxes and everything is going really well there and somebody still hasn't been able to conceive, then I start to look into more advanced testing, right? So ruling out endometritis, which is inflammation in the uterine lining, doing immunological panels to see what are the ratios in your immune cells. That can sometimes point to the cause of your infertility. Maybe ruling out celiac disease. It's crazy to even think about, but I have had cases in my practice where, you know, these women, they're experiencing recurring losses to me, which to me screams autoimmunity, and they're having these autoimmune panels done, but the doctor will miss like one or two types of like autoimmune condition. And then I'll recommend, okay, let's test for that. Turns out they have it. We do a little bit of work on the gut, and then it leads to a successful conception, pregnancy, and birth. So yeah, like celiac is one that I might look at, looking at the thyroid antibodies. So that would be the more advanced stage of testing. Sometimes I'll recommend doing a vaginal microbiome swab, especially if you're somebody who's taken a lot of antibiotics or has been prone to bacterial vaginosis or yeast infections or UTIs, because the vaginal microbiome communicates a lot up to the uterine microbiome. And if there's a lot of imbalance there, if there's a lot of dysbiosis, then it can be communicating to the uterine microbiome that this is not a safe place for procreation. And so by changing the environment in the vaginal microbiome, we can also reduce any localized inflammation in the uterus as well. So those are just a handful of ways that I like to support my endometriosis patients with fertility objectives.
You know, many years ago, like maybe more than 5 years ago, my gut's always been a something that I've struggled with, but I thought I was getting UTIs all the time, separately, you know, after sex, I would just like have those symptoms. I learned now, many years later, that like my pelvic floor is probably just too tight. I'm an aerialist, I'm a dancer, really tight pelvic floor, really hypotonic, and I was taking antibiotics for you to, and then my gut got destroyed. What have you seen with like, when you say history of antibiotics, what does that mean to you? Like, is it like, how much are people taking it and what are the effects? And like, what have you seen? Like, okay, they take it just once and it can destroy things, like really put you on a path that's not great? Or is it people that like me who was having antibiotics like on a regular basis sometimes? Like, can you talk about that?
Yeah, there's a couple of things I would consider. So, I mean, obviously there are things that set you up for success with gut health, like if you've been breastfed and, you know, if you were allowed to play in the dirt as a kid, right? Things that really help you build your immune system from those early stages of life, those things will really set you up for success. And so if kind of all of the boxes are being checked off for things that are not supportive of good gut health, in somebody who's taken antibiotics, then they're more likely to become symptomatic. Let me take a step back here because I think I'm getting a little bit confusing. So, what I would consider excessive use of antibiotics is three or more rounds in any 1 year period of your life. So, I always ask people, did you have antibiotics as a baby? What about as a child? What about as a teenager? What about as a young adult? Because three or more rounds in 1 year is going to be a really big hit to the gut. So that's my first question. And then I'll ask, did your digestion change after that? So if they started noticing more endo pain, if they started noticing changes in their bowel routine, if they started getting sick more often, then yeah, the wheels are starting to turn for me that probably did it. There was probably a really big hit on your gut with that three rounds of antibiotics. Now, whether those three rounds of antibiotics in any 1 year period are enough to either wipe away extremely important species in your large intestine or not, that's where some of the things that I was like previously alluded to matter, right? Were you breastfed? What is your diet like? Like if you're routinely eating a lot of colorful plant foods in your diet, if you're eating a lot of prebiotic rich foods in the diet, if you're eating a lot of fermented foods in the diet, if you're managing your stress really well, if you're not drinking a lot of alcohol, if you are, you know, getting in enough vitamin D and retinol, which is active form vitamin A, if you're getting a lot of zinc in the diet, your gut, even if you've taken those antibiotics, you're going to be slightly better off. Like you're going to be set up for more success, even if you've taken those antibiotics, if you're doing all of the above, right? If you're doing all of those things, if you were breastfed as a child, if had those opportunities in the early stages of your life to develop your immune system and your gut. But I forgot the question, Carrie. I'm
No, you
sorry.
kind of answered it because I
Yeah, I
wondered
think I
what
did,
you,
right?
yeah, what you think is
Yeah.
regard
Yeah.
as a lot of antibiotics.
Yeah. So
Man, I've had medical doctors, I've had MDs tell me there are no drawbacks to taking antibiotics.
it's just ridiculous.
I mean, even as a layperson, I know that's not true. It's like
One round of a broad spectrum antibiotic will wipe away about 30% of your large intestine microbiome. So consider those people who are not set up for success, who are maybe not eating a lot of colorful plant foods, but are rather eating a lot of processed foods that really don't help support a healthy, diverse gut microbiome. That one round and wiping away that 30% is probably going to be much, much bigger hit, right? So, it's one of my biggest frustrations as a healthcare provider is this extreme over-prescribing of antibiotics because it's extremely destructive. And I can't even tell you how many people I've connected with who tell me the exact same story. I was getting recurring UTIs. They turned out not to be UTIs. They were just probably endo on the ureters or on the bladder causing these symptoms. But they were getting prescription antibiotics every single time they were experiencing the symptoms. Then all of a sudden, over about a 6 to 12 month period, their endometriosis symptoms exploded. They started having extreme pain all cycle long. Their digestion changed, their stools changed, their energy levels tanked. They started getting sick more often. I see the same pattern all of the time. And I'm confident, I'm 100% confident it's related to the destructive nature of those antibiotics wiping away the flora in the large intestine. You need that bacterial diversity to maintain what's going on within the gut and to protect you from what's on the outside of your gut, which is your bloodstream. If you don't have that little army of bacteria keeping your gut lining secure and safe, from your gut that aren't supposed to get into your bloodstream will start moving across. And now you're going to get body-wide symptoms like hives, or you're going to develop autoimmunity, or you're going to start swelling, or your energy levels will tank, and the list goes on. So, yeah, I'm really passionate about communicating and wanting people to understand that they're not benign. They will cause damage in the body. That being said, if there's like a life-threatening condition or something that you can't avoid taking antibiotics for, you just have to take the antibiotics, absolutely take them. But educate yourself on how to support your gut, right? So that you can recover any bacterial diversity that was lost and really avoid trying to take them, you know, back to back if you can. But that is if you can, right? Don't avoid antibiotics just because you heard me talk about it on this podcast. If you absolutely need them, if you're getting recurring UTIs, always have yourself cultured, because it can turn out that it's not actually UTIs. It could just be that you're getting UTI-like symptoms and then you'd be taking antibiotics unnecessarily. So yeah, it's a frustration of mine. So I'm sorry, I needed to get that out.
No, it's fine. It was... me too, because like no one was looking at my overall holistic in a holistic way, you know, just like really looking at the one thing. The one doctor would see the one thing, prescribe for that thing. And, you know, now that I have this podcast and I talk to all these women, it's so common for us to have a tight pelvic floor, too tight, like so common. And, you know, I've heard the story, and then other women, oh, I have UTIs, but they're not. And how do we actually, and now I have this breathing technique that allows me to relax and those symptoms go away. It's amazing. I'm like, I wish I knew this earlier. Cindy, let's wrap with one more question, because I know your time is so valuable. So if you have any advice for my population of women out there, so these women are very fit. They're looking for ways to, they already have a healthy lifestyle generally. How does your practice come into effect with these type of women, if they have endo or if they're starting to have those symptoms and they just don't know what they have yet?
Yeah, I would say the biggest thing that we didn't talk too much about in this population would be to make sure that you're eating enough. And that, like, particularly carbs, if you're doing a lot of cardio, or adequate protein if you're trying to build muscle, or if that's just kind of a natural effect of the type of movement that you're doing, you really need to be eating enough, right? Because you're so active. And one of the things that our bodies perceive as physiological stressors is under eating, right? So when you're very, very active, you're going to be burning a lot more energy. So that is one thing I would say. The second is make sure you're replenishing all of your nervous system and adrenal supporting minerals, vitamins, and electrolytes. So you want to be considering sodium, potassium losses through sweat. You want to be considering magnesium losses through sweat. You also want to make sure you're getting adequate B vitamins, calcium, vitamin C. These are really important for your adrenal and nervous system function. And again, when you're very, very, very active, that's a big hit physiologically on your body, right? You want to make sure you're getting enough of these. And if you're active to the point where you're losing a lot of electrolytes and minerals through sweat, you really want to be on top of replenishing those. If you're not adequately replenishing those, it's going to have an effect on your adrenals, and you may start to experience burnout, right? You might start experiencing extreme fatigue, maybe, you know, reduced performance in the type of physical activity that you're doing. Your pain can get really extreme. Also, extreme physical activity or high intensity physical activity is a risk factor for leaky gut, right? Increased gaps in the cells lining the gut. Mm-hmm. So you want to, again, all the things I'm saying now apply. You can mitigate that risk by eating enough, getting enough colorful foods in the diet. So aim for 3+ different colors from plant foods specifically with every meal. Maybe talk to a provider about something like L-glutamine, or checking your zinc levels or your vitamin D levels. Just make sure that, because any of those, all three of those will really help support the gut lining as well. Maybe consider supplementing some concentrated prebiotic fibers like partially hydrolyzed guar gum or acacia fiber, or some kind of xylo-oligosaccharide or fructo-oligosaccharide. Or you could just type those into Google and it'll pull up a bunch of different options for you. But in this particular population, those will probably be the main things I would consider. In addition to all the other things that I shared with you today around like hormone balance and gut health and immune function. I mean, if you're that active, you're getting in a ton of movement, which is going to be very supportive for your immune system. But if you're exercising very aggressively and you're under eating, you're not replenishing those lost B vitamins or magnesium or sodium or potassium or whatever it is, that's not going to set you up for success when it comes to your gut lining. It's not going to set you up for success for adequate hormone production, which can also make your symptoms much, much more aggressive. And it's not going to set you up for success when it comes to your adrenal health. So that would be like the main really, really, really important thing for you to assess is that you're hitting all of your macronutrient needs, all of your micro mineral needs, and not showing any signs of depletion or like vitamin or mineral deficiencies.
This was so interesting, and I learned so much just in 1 hour.
I have that effect.
I love it. Cindy, thank you so much for carving out the time for us. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. It was nice to chat with you.
Cindy, thank you so much for coming on, lending us your wisdom and your knowledge on this topic. We appreciate you. And listeners, if you would honor me with a 5-star rating and review, I would appreciate it so much. Check out wrapyourheadaroundsilks.com. Lots of free resources there for you. And if you'd like to check out Greener Grass, the podcast I do with Kelly McVeigh, if you want to hear the sound of my voice, I'd love to have you. All right, guys, over and out. We'll see you next time. This is The Expecting Best.